Welcome to the Bylines Network podcast, an audio accompaniment to our growing family of regional Bylines publications, where progressive, high-quality citizen journalism speaks truth to power without fear or favour. Each week, our team will examine issues that matter, speaking to politicians, leaders, and activists across the country, putting the spotlight on voices outside the mainstream. This week, our hosts are me, Katrina Best, in East Sussex.
Me, Alex Toll, up in New York.
And me, Mary Pearson, in Grantham.
So, with the local elections coming up on May 6th, we wanted to dig deeper into the dismal statistic regarding voter turnout. The average turnout for local elections in the UK is only 35%, which is almost half that of general elections. And when we started to wonder aloud why so few people do vote locally, Kerry, I hope you don't mind, helped answer this by basically admitting that even though she's a dedicated voter, she didn't really know much about local elections.
Yeah, that's definitely right. I'm not that clued up on local elections, and that isn't to say that I'm not interested or that I don't care about local politics, because I do. I've voted in every election that I've been able to. I think that there's not a lot of information out there for young people and just people in general to understand what local elections are all about.
Okay, and I don't know how you feel, Alex, if you feel very up to speed on them. I think actually it's true of most people that they don't really know. When you think of a local council, you think bins or roads or maybe schools or something, but you're not really clear on which council does what. So I thought it might be fun to do a little quiz and see if you and Kerry can kind of know which layer of government, local government, does what.
This is going to be really embarrassing because I spend most of my time reporting on local democracy. I spend my master's writing about local democracy, and I am not sure I'm going to do very well here.
Well,
I'm ready for the challenge though.
Okay, good. I am afraid to say there's no actual prize except bragging rights. But
I think if I lose, I'll drop out my master's. There's that.
Oh, no, don't do that. Okay, so unitary authorities aside, that's something we're going to talk about later. In most districts, I think it's true to say, in the UK, certainly in England, they're made up of layers of local government. And so you've got parish / town, district and county. Okay, those are the three. So I'm going to give you a service and you tell me which one you think is responsible for it. Okay.
Okay.
So education.
I think that is the county council.
I'm going to say county. Yeah.
You're both correct. Yes. Well done.
Good stuff.
Okay, bin collection or waste collection?
I think that is parish and town council.
I'm trying to think what's on my bins back at home. I think it says North Norfolk District Council, so I'm going to say District Council.
Alex is right. You get to stay on your masters.
Thank goodness.
Footpaths.
I think footpaths are parish, you know, top of my head.
You're right.
I was going to... Oh,
sorry, Kerry. Sorry.
You know, I'm going to apply for a PhD now.
I think you maybe should. What about planning applications?
County council.
Planning applications, because that's where the whole neighbourhood planning stuff comes in and all the referendums. I think Kerry's right. I think it's county.
I'm afraid you're both wrong. It's district.
No.
What about highways?
Definitely county.
I'm going to say county.
You're right. That is true. And what about revenue collection, as in council tax?
That's county, I'm pretty sure, yeah.
Yeah, I think that it must be county.
Surprisingly, it isn't. It's district.
Really?
That is surprising.
Oh. Less sure about that PhD now.
And last, but definitely not least, cemeteries.
Gonna say parish.
Yeah, I think parish as well.
Yeah, parish and town. That's right. Mm-hmm. Well, I think you both pass.
Yeah, I'm quite surprised with myself, actually.
But now, luckily, I don't have to try and explain all the different kinds of mayor that there are, which I only just learned. So,
okay, so I'm going to try to give a rough breakdown of what is up for election and who you can vote for. So the good news here is that everyone in Scotland, Wales and England has someone to vote for. If you live in Scotland and Wales, you have devolved parliaments to vote for. If you live in England and Wales, you have police and crime commissioners to vote for. Now we get down to the council level. And this now only affects England. If you live in Scotland and Wales, your local councillors are up for election in 2022. Now, generally speaking, everyone is governed by about three different arrangements. If you live in a highly urbanised area, so for instance, Liverpool, Leeds, Newcastle, Birmingham, London, these sorts of areas, you will be governed by a metropolitan borough. Generally, these elect a third of councillors every 3 years and then take a break for the fourth. 2020 was meant to be one of those years where they elected a third, but obviously the elections got delayed until 2021. Above that metropolitan borough level, if you live in one of these more urban areas, you may well have a combined authority. So for instance, if I live in Greater Manchester, I will have my metropolitan borough and above that, the Greater Manchester Combined Authority. You can't vote necessarily for who is on that sort of governing board. That'll just be council leaders, leaders of local enterprise partnerships, but you can vote for who is in charge of it, the Metro Mayor. Next, you go to more rural areas, towns, small cities. That is most likely to be governed by a district council, and above that, a county council. So for instance, here, my mum lives in Norfolk. She's governed by North Norfolk District Council, and above that, Norfolk County Council. Some district councils were up for election in 2020 and delayed until 2021. And then county councils were always going to be elected in 2021. So lots of those are happening together this year. This is now where things get complicated. So over the last 15 years, government has been trying to simplify down governing arrangements into unitary authorities. These, generally speaking, take one of two forms. Either it's going to be the case that district councils and county councils have been kind of mushed together to create these super county councils. So for instance, here my dad lives up in Northumberland. Even though it's a rural area, he doesn't have a district council, but just has the unitary authority governing him, Northumberland County Council. The other type is when a small city, so for instance, York, where I live, kind of goes independent from the county council. So York is nominally speaking in the county of North Yorkshire. I can vote for the North Yorkshire Police, Fire and Crime Commissioner, but I'm governed by a separate unitary authority. What's annoying here is that these are elected, not quite at random, but they're elected on a very independent schedule. So my dad can vote for his unitary authority councillor in Northumberland this year. I can't vote for my unitary authority councillor in York until 2023. That's a rough breakdown of how things are governed. We haven't gone into parish councils because they're elected in a very different kind of way, but that is a rough kind of breakdown.
Wow, thanks, Alex. That was really interesting and really insightful. And we've now got someone who can shed even more light on the matter.
So we're really pleased to have as our special guest to help us decipher the whole local election issue, Rachel Farrington, who founded the incredibly informative site votingcounts.org.uk. Welcome, Rachel. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
So you founded your website votingcounts.org.uk, a fantastic non-partisan resource, back in 2014 when you were still an A-level student. Can you tell us what prompted you to do that and whether it achieved what you'd hoped and how it's evolved?
Sure. So essentially, I was 17 and the European elections were coming up in 2014. And I was having a chat with some of my friends who had just turned 18 and were going to get to vote for the first time. I wasn't going to get to. So I was convinced that I needed to get all my friends out voting. And I was one of the only ones of my friendship group that were doing politics as an A-level. And so they would come to me and say, right, what is this election all about? Who am I voting for? What am I actually voting for? And I had this conversation a few times, and I have my own political views and allegiances. And I thought, well, my friends are clever enough to make their own decisions. Like, I don't just have to tell them, I shouldn't be telling them how to vote or make a decision for them. So I thought, right, well, I'm going to collate the information for them and tell them why it's important to vote, what they're voting for, and who the political parties were, and let them to decide for themselves. So I did a bit of website design on the side, as many teenagers do, not. but I used that kind of platform and those skills I had to kind of put together this website. And it did start off as kind of a list of reasons why you should vote in a general election. But then it's kind of expanded. And as I went off to university, a lot of my friends got involved from all political parties, all political persuasions. And we've kind of built up this resource that is peer reviewed, it's cross-party, and it's there to help people make their own decisions and to give them the information they need to walk into a polling booth and know what they're voting for.
Brilliant, brilliant. And not just walk into a polling booth, but vote by post or by proxy, which are the other two options, which I think not everyone realises that. And I think this show is going out, correct me if I'm wrong, on the 18th, which is the day before the deadline, or is it two days before
the deadline? So the voter registration deadline is the 19th, and the postal vote application deadline is the 20th, unless you live in Scotland, when it's because it's already passed for Scotland. I'm not quite sure why, but their deadline was the 6th of April.
So we were pretty shocked to learn that the average voter turnout in local elections in the UK is only around 35%. I believe that's correct, which is even worse than the general election turnout, which is not even 70%. So just curious to know what your thoughts are on why this is and what can be done to get more people engaged enough to want to cast their vote.
I think for many people, it's kind of understanding what the council does and how it affects their lives. So, I mean, you can all name the first thing that councils do for us, and that's your local bin collection. But kind of after that, some people don't make the connection. They use council services or they access council services all day, every day, and don't quite realise that they are. And there is that education piece in that you might really care about your local community centre or your local park, but if you're not quite sure who runs it or that you can have a say in who runs it and how money is spent in your community, then you're probably not going to engage with that process. If you think that councils do is bins, then there's not much motivation to get involved. So I think there's some confusion, and even I don't always know exactly where things sit. Between, is it central government, is it local council, is it the mayor, is it borough council, is it kind of unitary authority? There's so many different types and levels of government that it can all get a bit confusing. And I think it's about having that tangible link to, this is how my local council affects my life, and therefore I should have a say in who's running that.
Yeah, that's a very good point. And actually, before you came on, we had a little mini quiz to find out if, you know, how much people knew about which layer of local government did what, and it is very confusing, and I don't think any of us can be really clear.
Definitely. And I think the analogy I've started to use more frequently is when you go to the doctor's surgery, they have those great posters which tell you which NHS service you need for which ailment. So if you've broken your arm, you need to go to A&E. And if you just need some paracetamol, we should probably go to your local pharmacy or a shop. But we don't really have that for government. So if I have an issue, say childcare in my local community is not up to standard, do I contact my local MP about that? Or do I contact my local council? Or is it the parish council? And if you don't know, then you won't engage. And maybe you'll go off and find an independent group and find a charity that helps. I don't know. So I think it's definitely a disconnection. Yeah. I always think if the NHS has to advertise what services are needed, then definitely government does too.
Well, thank you. That actually is very helpful. And we're trying to understand it all a little bit better. And I think, correct me if I'm wrong, that the county and district and parish town is mostly happening throughout England this time.
Yeah, so the council elections this year are in England. Some of them have been passed over from last year, but they couldn't happen because of the pandemic. So there is a lot more council elections this year than there was last year. And depending on where you live in England, it will either be for kind of a county council, a unitary authority, or district council. It usually, whether you live in a urban area or a rural area, will determine what type of council you have.
Right, okay. And of course, this year in Wales, it's quite exciting for 16 to 18 year olds who are getting to vote for the first time. So I'm just wondering if you think it'll make a big difference to the results there, and more importantly, whether you think that being able to vote from age 16 would potentially result in better lifelong engagement with voting politics.
Definitely. I think there's definitely something to be said for getting in the habit of voting. It sounds so silly, but if you vote when you're first able to, i.e. when you're 16 or 18, depending on where you live, then you're more likely to turn out in future for different types of election. So if you get in the habit of going down to the polling station or voting by post, it almost triggers something in your brain to realise how easy it is, and you're more likely to do it in future. So getting people engaged at a young age, it's a lot easier then to make sure that turnout continues rather than trying to convince someone who's never voted for 30 years that they need to suddenly start doing so.
One of the things that is quite fascinating, you've been putting some information out about the various mayors that are up for election this time, and I was interested to discover that there's more than one type of mayor. In fact, more than two types of mayor. So it'd be great if you could enlighten us a bit about the differences between these mayors and what that means. And also, the other thing that's up for election that I think a lot of people don't know about is the police and crime commissioners. We have one in my area, which is East Sussex. But I understand that in some instances, mayors do that too. So it's quite confusing, I think, for people. So if you can shed any light on that, that would be great.
So there is a lot of layers of elections this year. So in terms of mayors, often when you think about a mayor, you think about a guy with a big gold chain that goes around and opens buildings. But that's a ceremonial mayor, and they're appointed rather than elected. But then there's several layers of different elected mayors where you actually get to decide who your mayor is going to be. So it might be the mayor of your town or your city, or it might be the mayor of your region. So, for example, if we just look at what they call single authority mayors, which are kind of so the mayor of Liverpool, the mayor of Hackney, the mayor of Doncaster, mayor of Bristol, those kind of mayors, they'll be the head of the council and they'll be leading all of the councillors that you're also electing. Right. And then there's another layer of mayor called combined authority mayors. And these are mayors that represent a wider region, often have a big pot of funding from central government, and have a lot more powers. So for example, you have the mayor of Greater Manchester, the mayor of Liverpool City Region, mayor of the West Midlands, all of those kind of mayors as well. So each of those mayors has slightly different powers and responsibilities depending on the agreement that they've reached with central government. So it's not straightforward. And we were having a chat before we started recording about the mayor of Liverpool. And this gets confusing because you have a ceremonial mayor of Liverpool. Wow. You have a mayor of Liverpool who leads the council. And then you have the mayor of Liverpool City Region, which doesn't just cover Liverpool. It covers some of the neighbouring towns such as St. Helens and the Wirral, etc. And the mayor of Liverpool City Region has a lot more power. So they'll be looking at kind of the transport for the wider region. They'll be looking at environmental and energy decisions, housing, cultural life within the city. Essentially, they just have a lot more funding and have those extra powers to make a real difference to the wider region. Right. And then to add to it all, you've got the police and crime commissioners. So everywhere in England and Wales has a police and crime commissioner. And these people are kind of head up, are the public facing figure of the police. So they will set the strategic direction for the police and decide when, have some kind of budgetary responsibilities in deciding where police funding should be allocated, and ultimately are responsible for the actions of their policing region. In some areas, so West Yorkshire, London, and Greater Manchester, the mayors are actually your police and crime commissioner. So Sadiq Khan in London at the moment is the current police and crime commissioner for London. But then he also works with Cressida Dick, who is the, I forget her actual job title, but she's the head of the Met. So they'll work together to coordinate the policing output. And again, in Greater Manchester, it will be the same for currently Andy Burnham too.
So we're talking about next week, actually, we're going to be talking more about sort of the voting system and democracy and that kind of thing. But I wanted to ask you a question about this, the voting system nonetheless, because many people say they feel disenfranchised. I think partly because of we have the first past the post winner takes all system, meaning that many politicians are elected by a minority, both in general elections and in local elections. But I think other voters feel there's, or non-voters, I should say, feel there's no point voting because they live in such a safe seat where nobody else stands a chance. So what's the point? Or they complain that all local politicians are the same anyway. So I'm just wondering if you have some good sort of stirring advice to give to.
So I get this question a lot, and it for many people, whether it be the electoral system or whether it be because they live in a safe seat, all those kind of things, people say, oh, my vote won't actually change anything.
Yeah.
I like to argue there is no such thing as a safe seat. We've actually got a tool on our website. This is very general election focused, but I think the principles of it are definitely applicable to locals. So I have a list here of all of the vote, the number of votes cast in each constituency in the UK. And I also have a list of how many people didn't vote in that constituency. So I'm on the first page of this list here. So I'm gonna pick out Amber Valley. And Amber Valley, the majority, so the MP that was elected there had a majority of 16,886 votes in 2019. So that's how many votes they had ahead of their nearest rival. In that constituency, 24,258 people didn't vote. So although that may be seen as a safe seat, as in they've got 16,000 votes more than their rival, 24,000 people didn't vote in that constituency.
Right.
So to say my vote won't make a difference, well, if everyone thinks like that, you end up with a lot of people not voting, and actually that they really could have changed the result. They could have reinforced the vote, the result. We can't know because they didn't vote. And also, kind of voting for someone who won't win isn't a wasted vote. So especially in general elections, you have party funding called short funding, which is actually allocated on the basis of proportion of the vote. And you also have candidates have to put down substantial deposits to run in elections. And if they don't get enough votes, they lose those deposits. So if you're quite a small party and you're putting up £500 and you lose that, that very soon starts to impact the way you can run your political party. Where if you get that £500 back because you've got a certain proportion of the vote, you'll be able to use that £500 to keep on your campaign and keep keep campaigning and stand at the next election.
Now, it's unlikely that we will see drastic changes to the law, such as making voting in elections mandatory as it is in Australia, for instance. So what do you think ordinary citizens can do to help increase voter turnout, especially in local elections?
I think making it the norm. I know it sounds silly, but we've seen it with the vaccines. Everyone's posting a picture of them going out and getting a vaccine. So it feels normal to go out and get your vaccine if that's what you want to do. So I think kind of showing that it's a civic engagement, it's you getting involved in your community, maybe even having conversations with your friends. Maybe you're sat in the park with socially distanced in your group of six, and you say, you know, this park is actually run by the local council who are up for election this year, and I don't think it's being looked after, so I'm going to vote for this person who says they're going to look after it. Or maybe you're in the doctor's surgery and you realize that certain things within the healthcare of your area are funded by the local council or funded in part by your mayor. maybe you want to have a say at that, have a conversation with your friends and say, actually, there's a real opportunity here for us to influence the result.
Okay, brilliant. Well, thank you. Thank you so much for helping us. I hate that expression, unpack, but I'm sort of using it. The whole local elections thing. And I would urge anybody to go to your site, which is brilliant, and also has a handy local elections countdown clock on it.
Yes. You know, to,
which is great. So you can, but yes, to, you've got so much information on there. And like you said, it's all nonpartisan. It's just informing people about how to vote, where to vote.
So if you go on to our Vote 2021 page, which is votingcurrents.org.uk/vote2021, you can scroll down and there is a fantastic tool which has been built by an organisation called Democracy Club. But on that page, you can type in your postcode and it will tell you where your polling station is and, more importantly, who your candidates are. And it's so important you take a quick look at their socials, take a look at their website, see what they've got to say, because even if they're a member of a political party, not every member of a political party thinks the same thing. And you can pick out a candidate that actually is most closely aligned with your views.
Thank you so much to Rachel for a really interesting conversation. Be sure to check out Rachel's website, votingcounts.org.uk, to find out more about voting. So we're delighted to be joined today by Professor Colin Copus of De Montfort University, specialist in local government. Colin, thanks so much for appearing on the podcast.
Pleasure, absolute pleasure.
So we kind of came to this with this sort of central question of why don't people vote in local elections? And one thing that we really came down to is the fact that local government itself is very peculiar in this country. Could you give us a quick breakdown of what local government does and I guess some of the problems which you have diagnosed with how local government works to encouraging this sort of turnout problem?
Sure. I think it is very strange. And I sort of try and describe it as saying that local government in England is not really local, and it certainly isn't government. Yet we insist on keeping to this term. And I'll explain that a little bit. Firstly, we have some of the largest units of local government, certainly across Europe and probably beyond. So the idea that little local settlements have their own councils that run vital services and govern and allow an element of local self-government in real communities has disappeared in this country. We have councils with made up names. We have councils with points of the compass in them that are so big that they don't really resonate with people living in the communities that they experience on a day to day basis. And because of the legal framework of local government in this country, it can't really govern. It can't govern in the way that you would expect any other organisation to be able to do, with levels of autonomy and freedom and financial backing. So it's a very, we hold on to this title for romantic reasons rather than real reasons, local government. But having said that, local government in this country spends something like £40 billion over the course of a year, although certainly the last account showed about that much. That's a tremendous amount of money. It spends that money on something like 800 different council services. Now, you might think to yourself, 800, that's a, you know, it's a staggering amount. But when you think about it and all the associated things, there's housing, education, social care, planning, environmental health, trading standards, street lighting, road maintenance, business support, transport, waste management, that soon grows into a huge network of vital public services, all provided by this institution called local government. It's also a big taxing institution. It can tax its citizens. So you have this sort of framework, lots of services, lots of money, tax raising powers. So we're left with that big question, why do about only a third or just over a third of voters regularly turn out in local government elections? And quite often, I think one is, as I say, the size of local government in this country, which means to say we have fewer councillors than other countries across Europe. So we've got these two factors coming into play. And I don't think it's a coincidence that this country sits at absolutely rock bottom in the league table of turnouts in local elections across Europe, absolutely at the bottom. Even if you take out those few countries like Belgium that have compulsory voting, so they regularly get 90%. And I don't think it's any coincidence that we have, you know, that we're at that position because we have these units that are so big, because we have so few councillors, and also because we have a highly centralised governing system. I think a lot of people know that the real decisions are made in Whitehall and Westminster, that local government powers and autonomy is heavily restricted in terms of what it can do within the, in its localities. So I think big local government, fewer councils than anywhere else, no real independent powers to govern localities in the sense that you would expect a government to do, heavily centralised political culture, a government, not this particular government, every government, and indeed the permanent civil service, see local government as a delivery agency for their policies rather than an independent organisation for self, for local self-government. Is this likely to change? I mean, I live in hope. I think one day the penny will drop at the centre, that controlling everything isn't necessarily the best way of doing it.
I think one thing that's really interesting that's kind of come out of what we've been talking about quite a lot is how your vision of this kind of these smaller units of local government being more effective really contrasts with the approach, not only, again, not only of this government, but of previous government, this kind of focus on the region. So do you think that's completely the wrong way to be going with this?
Yeah, I do. I absolutely do. There is a sort of obsession at the centre, and indeed for some in local government, for an intermediary body between the centre and local government. Now, when you think about this, so you've got Westminster, Scottish Parliament, Westminster, Welsh Assembly, Westminster, English local government. So the clearly missing bit in that jigsaw is an English Parliament, not regional assemblies. Because the reality of the English regions are that they fall into the same trap as much of our local government. Huge entities, anonymous, often with points of the compass in their title. You know, the seven of the nine English regions have points of the compass in their title. Only two of them relate to what you might consider to be places. So nine regions for a population of 56 million. You look at Italy, they have something like 20 regions for a population just a bit larger than England, and not one of those 20 regions has a point of the compass in its title. So I think, so that, you know, to me, regionalism is a romantic nonsense. There is no English Catalonia. What worries me about these sort of approaches to sub-regional devolution is that they operate often on the basis of a number of councils coming together to create this combined authority, to then have a directly elected mayor. I don't have a problem with that. I think, in a huge area that some of these regions, sub-regions cover, having a directly elected mayor gives it some personality that it doesn't otherwise have. You know, the lunacy of having the council leaders in a combined authority area. Whereas you can point to Scotland and Wales and say that is devolution, what you've seen there is the passing down of primary legislative powers to a constituent part of the United Kingdom. That's not what local government or combined authorities are getting. And it's not just plain, it's not semantics to say we've not really seen devolution, what we're seeing is decentralisation. It's important to grasp that point, that yet again, England has been shortchanged in the devolution stakes, and so too is its local government. And we need to grasp that fact, I think, because until we do, you won't see massive turnouts in local or subnational elections. And I, you know, I think that there are times when the public are not as green as their cabbage looking. You know, they get this. People get this. Otherwise, there wouldn't be these huge differences in turnouts, you know, apart from the other factors I've mentioned.
Yeah. And there's this sort of really untouched element when everyone talks about local democracy, which is that we often forget that actually most of these councillors get at most a sort of a part-time stipend. We're sort of operating with this sort of incredibly sort of unprofessionalised sector. And that's no more the case than at the parish level, which we haven't really talked about much, but obviously these much smaller units, which might actually accord closer to what you're saying about that sort of local responsive government.
Yeah.
But they get, one of the actual presenters on the podcast as a parish councillor, she says she gets, I think, about £150 a year to do that. And
yeah, it doesn't pay the phone bill.
No, exactly. Yeah. And it's kind of that question of, well, if we really want to have a local government sector that does everything that it kind of sets out to do, do we really need to put some more money into making sure these are full-time jobs?
That's the $64,000 question. That's the big question. We get our local democracy on the cheap. And yes, you're right. We have a sort of begrudging attitude towards recompense for certainly for councillors in the way that the work that they have to do. And I think that's no more clearer than in the parish council sector, where, you know, vast swathes of councillors won't take up the allowances that are available to them. They do that voluntarily. They decide they're not going to do that. And it's really interesting because of the smallness of many parishes. I mean, you know, we shouldn't run away with the idea that they're all like the Vicar of Dibley. That's not a parish council. That was a parochial church council. And even most of those are not like that. Now, some of them, if you look at some of our bigger town councils, are quite, you know, going concerns. They employ a goodly number of folk. They provide a goodly number of public services. They have councillors that are probably spending as much time on their duties as district and county councillors will, and the vast majority, not receiving any recompense for that. That's their choice largely, but they'll be the folk, certainly in the smaller areas, that, you know, people will know, oh, I'll go and have a word with so-and-so because I know they're on the council, and they'll, you know, and yes, okay, I'll take that up. But that's the county council's job, or it's the unitary authority's job. But because they're more likely to be more identifiable within the community, they will pick all of this up. You know, with this sort of that sort of work, it's almost 24-hour a day for some council. You know, the phone will ring all hours of the day and night, from first thing in the morning to, you know, to last thing at night. Is it time for councillors to be full-time and salaried? I think a lot of councillors would say no, interestingly enough, on the basis that they don't want their job to become professionalised, not in the sense that they're not professional about what they do and they don't take care and look very carefully at their duties, not unprofessional in that sense, but they don't want to become salaried, because that then, I think in their minds, creates a distance between them and the people that they're representing. You know, we might not be ready yet to say, look, what we have amongst our councillors are adult, grown-up politicians, and we're going to pay them like that. But I hope we're a lot closer to saying we need to give them the tools to get on with the job, particularly if this journey of bigger and bigger, ultimately to fewer and fewer councillors, but the work that they do doesn't go away.
Yeah.
That doesn't disappear. The casework doesn't go away. The pressures that they're under, community leadership doesn't stop. So unless we provide them with that sort of support, then that institution of local government, local democracy becomes more and more hollowed out, I think.
Thank you so much to Colin and Rachel for speaking with us today. If you want to find out more about local democracy, check the links in our show notes for more information.
Be sure to tune into next week's episode about why democracy matters with Abby James from Make Votes Matter Manchester and with Naomi Smith from Gasp for Britain.
This week's episode was hosted by Katrina Best, Alex Toll and Kerry Pearson. The editor was Julian Greenbank.
The music is Voxel Revolution by Kevin MacLeod. Thanks, Kevin.
The Bylines Network is supported by Byline Times and the trading brand of March for Change.
Be sure to check us out on social media at Bylines Pod. Thanks for listening.